So I've been in the Cancer Prevention Control Department for about 10 years now.
Maybe a little longer. Came in as a postdoc and just stayed on
afterwards. And so I sort of come in at this from a background in nutrition. I did my master's in nutrition. I did my PhD in epidemiology. I was working on breast density at the time. And then more recently, I'm working more in immune function and breast cancer prognosis, looking at disparities. So that's just to give you a background of myself. So I was tasked with just a very general presentation about cancer epidemiology or epidemiology in general, and so I'm focusing on descriptive epidemiology, and then following that up with survivorship, which is a very big area and topic that's been around maybe 20 years, but I would say within the last 10 years has really emerged as a new topic area and a new area that a lot of different cancer institutes are trying to get into and a lot of researchers are trying to get into. So epidemiology is the study of the distribution and determinants of disease frequency in human populations. And so there's an assumption that has to be made, which is that human disease really doesn't occur randomly, that there are causes to disease and that there are factors that can explain what's causing the disease, where it's occurring, who gets it, and that you can determine these causes through systematic investigation. So some of the big questions in epidemiology are disease frequency, how many people are getting the disease, distribution of the disease, who's getting the disease, and when and where does that occur. And that's very important for infectious disease epidemiology. And then a lot of things that we do in the department and at Roswell is looking at the determinants of disease. And a lot of the work here is on the looking at molecular epidemiology, where you're focused in on pathways, on mechanisms. And there's a lot of work as well in disparities and behavioral health. So looking at descriptive epidemiology, it's really focused on describing or characterizing who develops disease and the characteristics of the people that develop the disease. And so what it does is provide a systematic method for characterizing the health problem, providing basic data on health, disease, and mortality. You want to understand the basic dimensions of the health problem, and it helps to identify populations that are at higher risk for the for various conditions. And so you want to know characteristics such as who gets the disease, where the disease occurs, and sometimes the timing of the disease, especially in relation to various exposures. And this kind of information is really important on the government level and on the policy level, because you're trying to use this information to figure out how you're going to allocate resources to build programs. And it also, and this type of information also is important for researchers because it enables development of hypotheses. So it sort of gives clues as to what might be happening. So there's two types of observational studies. So there's the randomized trial, which I'm not even talking about, where you're giving a person a particular intervention or treatment, and then you want to know what happens to them. In observational studies, these studies really are looking at free living individuals. And so there you have a lot of more issues to deal with, because in free living individuals, there's a lot of correlation between various factors. But the two main types of studies are descriptive. So that's where the studies are dealing with questions of who, what, when, and why. You're just describing the people and the disease relationship with the individuals. So there's no preconceived ideas about the relation between your exposure and your disease. And the results then can suggest hypotheses that you can test in analytical studies. So in analytical epidemiology, it deals then with particular questions of why something happens or how something happens. And there's two types. Can I just get a hand, sort of a hand up? Who's had some like background in epidemiology and study design? Okay, thank you. Not many. Okay. So there's two types of main studies. There's three types, but I'm just going to talk about two. So there's the two main types of epi studies is a case control study, which is retrospective in nature, and a cohort study, which is prospective in nature. And I'll talk about this a little further.
So in the first, this is a cross-sectional study, the first one, and basically what you're doing there is you're assessing the exposure at the same time as the disease. So you might say, let's say one of the earlier studies of smoking and lung cancer, you might say, oh, smoking is associated with lung cancer, but at the time, if you're doing a cross-sectional study, you won't know if it's causal or not because you're assessing the exposure and the disease at exactly the same time. All you know is that there's a link, there's an association. In a case control study, which is retrospective, what researchers normally do is they take people who have a disease, so let's say a person that has cancer, and then you want to compare them to people who don't have cancer. So you're going to have two populations. You'll have your cases, which are your, you know, the people with the disease of interest, and your controls, which are the comparison group. So in theory, the people who are your controls, your comparison group, should be very much like the people who are cases from the same population pool, except that the only difference is that they don't have the disease that you're interested in. And so what you're doing there is you're assembling your group of disease and non-disease people, and then you're looking at a whole range of exposures. You might say, oh, between these two group of people, are there differences in diet? Are there differences in smoking rates? Are there differences in their lead exposure, etc.? So there you're trying to say, which exposure differentiates between the two groups, what is the cases more likely or less likely than the controls to be exposed to to an exposure of interest. So the other type of study is a cohort study. This is prospective in nature. And so here, what you're doing is you're assembling a group of people who are usually healthy at the very beginning. So let's say healthy women. You might assemble, let's say a million healthy women or 20,000 healthy women, and you look at all the exposures up front. You ask them about everything under the sun. You can ask about their diet, exercise, whatever you're interested in, and then you follow them forward until they get disease. And so there, the idea is then you look backward and say, well, which exposures were linked to later developing the disease? In the literature, normally the type of data that is given greater weight and is perceived as being stronger is prospective studies, because at the time when they were assembled, they didn't have the disease yet, and so there's less likelihood that the exposure, that when you assess all the different exposures, that was biased. There's some concerns, of course, that as you, I'm going to leave it at that. Case control studies, on the other hand, there's concerns from a sort of study design point of view that when you assemble your cases, sometimes the controls is very difficult to select. So if you took a bunch of cases and your controls were really, really different from your cases, they were more healthy, they're from a different background, let's say all your cases were young, but all your controls were old, and so they're different in some ways, sometimes what you find out in the study could be biased by the way you selected your controls. And that's for that reason, case control studies and results from case control studies are given less weight than cohort studies. So going back to descriptive epi, so really the goals are for evaluation of trends in health. You're trying to compare different populations. It's the basis, as we said, for planning provision of health services and for generation of hypotheses for analytic studies. So this gives the natural history of cancer-related cancer. And so the point here is just to give you an idea of various data sources that are available when studying different populations. So there's screening programs that are focused on disease onset. That information is collected. There potentially could be medical records that are collected within the hospital, and there's a lot of studies that will use this data. Hospital records, and then a lot, especially for cancer, hospital records are reported to the cancer registry, and so a lot of this data is available on a national level. And then death certificates,
are collected. So a lot of times when we do prospective studies, we look and we're looking at prognosis, we will link up to the National Death Index for death certificates just to look at causes of death. And then this actually should go right across this. There's various national surveys that are set up so that that monitors various risk factors for diseases and cancer as well. So these are some data sources that are important for cancer research. There's the SEER epidemiology and end results. This is the primary source of cancer statistics in the United States. It was begun in 1973 with just a core set of registries, and this has expanded over the years up to 2000. It's now composed of 17 population-based cancer registries, and that represents 28% of the U.S. population. And basically, it compiles reports for all cancer mortality of the entire country. Another really important source of information, particularly for risk factors, is the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. This is centered at the CDC, and it's the world's largest ongoing telephone health survey system. And what they do is track health conditions and risk behaviors, and each year they change the questions up a bit to depending on what is deemed important, what they're trying to collect information on. And so this has been in place since 1984. About 350,000 adults are interviewed every year. And since 2011, they've started sampling both landlines and cell phone lines, given that there's been this shift in the population in cell phone use and how and that being more common. So right now they collect data across the entire United States, as well as the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, and Guam. And really the information that's collected by this program is to identify emerging health problems, establish and track health objectives, and for the evaluation and development and evaluation of health policies and programs. So we know with cancer that it's caused by a variety of factors over a number of years, and that really it's important because of that to be able to follow and monitor trends across time. And so a lot of the BRFS data is focused on behavioral factors, and then for them to be able to look at whether policies that are put in place actually work, it's nice to be able to actually track outcomes and to track some of the risk factor behavior as well. And so this is really important because we know that about 50 to 75% of cancer deaths in the U.S. are caused by lifestyle-related factors. So some of the information that is tracked is tobacco use. We know that smoking causes 30% of all U.S. deaths from cancer, and that's the single most important risk factor for cancer. And so it's primarily involved in cancers of the larynx, mouth, esophageal, GI tract, bladder, and then it also seems to be involved in pancreas, kidney, cervix, stomach, and liver cancer. And so I think probably everybody's seen this, where it looks at trends in tobacco use and lung cancer in the United States across from the 1900s all the way to 2009. And so this is the per capita cigarette consumption. So in 1964, when the Surgeon General's report came out about tobacco smoking and lung cancer, there was this dramatic decline in smoking rates. And then because of the latency period between smoking and lung cancer, you then subsequently see about 30 years later declines in lung cancer rates and death rates in the men. And then in women who took up smoking later than men and then started reducing started quitting later, you see actually a lag between men and women as well. So that only more recently, since the 2000s, has the lung cancer death rates in women stabilized and started to go down. So this is trends in cigarette smoking from 1965 to 2011. And so the point here really is that after the Surgeon General's report came out, men actually reduced their smoking rates a lot faster than women did. And at the time, in this early period, women were really, a lot of them were taking up smoking and they were quitting at a lower rate quitting at a lower rate. And there was more advertising at this time that was targeted towards women. But more recently, you see a bit of closing, and that it's pretty much parallel and going down. Towards the end, the rate of decline has sort of really hasn't, have kind of flattened out a little bit. Okay. So this is smoking by race. So what it shows is that this is from 1991 to 2006, and so here we should see that Hispanics were less likely to smoke compared to whites and blacks, who were about at the mid 2000s, they were about almost identical rates. The initial decline amongst blacks was actually steeper, and then more recently, from 2004, there was a slight increase in smoking rates. So smoking, we also know, varies by education level. So those with less than high school had the highest rates in the 1990s. They declined, however, at the steepest rate. So at 2010, the rates of smoking between those who had less than high school education compared to those with high school education were almost identical, about 27%. And then both of those are higher than individuals who've had greater than a high school education. So these individuals were least likely to smoke. So it's also important to track smoking amongst high school students, and the reason is because most people who take up smoking do so before the age of 26, and so it's important to look at their rates, because once they've started smoking and are addicted, they're most likely to go on to become adult smokers. So this is looking at smoking trends for girls and boys, and this is from 1991 to 2011. And what it shows basically is that whites smoke more than African Americans or Hispanics. African Americans were the least likely to smoke, and that there was this sort of increase that went up to about late 1990s, and then there's been a decline since. More recently, this decline has really kind of flattened out for boys and girls, and that's part of that is that there's probably less money going into tobacco control for this group, and also there's more advertising targeting this group. Okay, if we look at, so this is from 2002 to 2010, and this is breaking down the ages of the children further, so that this is age 12 to 17, age 18 to 25. So over the period of 2002 to 2010, in the youngest group, there's actually been a decline in uptake of smoking, but then in the older group, from 18 to 25, there's been an increase. And so it's really it works out that there's a bit flat. So another risk factor that is tracked is fruit and vegetable consumption. We know that diets rich in plant foods, fruit and vegetables, are associated with lower rates of cancer in the mouth and pharynx. And the GI tract, and there's also some evidence for a role in colon cancer, pancreatic, and prostate cancer. So the recommendation is that individuals should get 4 to 13 servings of fruits and vegetables per day, depending on their energy needs, and the number that's usually thought about is that they need 5 servings of fruit and or vegetables in any given day. So this is the actual consumption amongst adults 25 and older in the U.S. in 2011. So consumption of 3 or more vegetable servings, and this is looking at it by educational status. So the red is less than high school, and the blue is high school or higher. And so what you see is that African Americans are actually the least likely to consume enough vegetables compared to whites, and the group that consumed the most were actually Hispanics. And overall, about 13% of individuals only, which is very low, like only 13% of individuals were able to report that they consumed 3 or more servings of vegetables per day, and then 16% if they had high school education or higher.
And then if we look at the fruit servings, this is actually a little bit better. So overall, this 28% of individuals who had less than high school education reported two or more fruit servings a day versus 32% who had high school or greater. And here, the Hispanics, again, had the highest levels of intake. And then amongst African Americans, this fruit intake was actually not too bad compared to whites. So, and then if we look at it by state, so this is adults and adolescents, and this is a percent of individuals report consuming vegetables less than one time per day. And this is from less than 20% all the way up to greater than 30%. So, you know, there's substantial room for improvement. And this is amongst adolescents. So adolescents even more so reported not consuming at least one serving of vegetables per day. So in terms of demographics, the fruit consumption is generally highest among the youngest and oldest segments of the population. So the little children and the older seniors, older individuals. It tends to increase with age, education, and income. And then if we look at racial and ethnic groups, blacks have the lowest intakes and Mexican Americans have the highest. And then amongst men actually, Mexican Americans, I'll just skip that. All right. And then the next is red meat and cancer. So this is tracked looking at meat intake. And because we know that red meat and processed meats are associated with increased risk of colorectal cancer, and that's a very strong association. And there's some evidence for other cancers as well, such as prostate and breast should probably be in there as well. There's some research that has suggested that processed is worse than fresh, but basically most of the research has focused in on red meat. And the increase in risk may be due to the iron in red meat, the fat in red meat, and then particularly nitrates or the preservatives, the nitrates and the nitrites when in processed meats. And then we know that with red meat, when it's cooked at high temperatures, that they tend to form, can form mutagenic or carcinogenic substances. So this has been the trend in meat consumption from early 1900s to 2012 in the United States. So while the red meat consumption really increased up to almost the 1980s, but there's been a sharp decline since then. And then in that same time, the poultry consumption, or primarily chicken consumption, has gone up. So despite the drop in beef consumption, the intake of meat in the United States per person is probably higher than anybody else on the planet. Alcohol intake is another one that's a risk factor that's tracked closely. We know that alcohol is associated with cancers of the mouth, upper GI tract, and it's also associated with increased risk of colorectal and breast cancer, postmenopausal breast cancer. And then on top of that, there seems to be interaction with alcohol and tobacco, where the two exposures in combination increases risk further than just, particularly with mouth, throat, and esophageal cancers, than either one alone. So this has been the alcohol consumption for individuals 14 and older from 1990 to 2009, and you see that there's a slow increase over time. So we know that many people start drinking fairly early in their teens, and among those aged 12 to 17, whites and Hispanics are more likely than blacks to use alcohol. And then amongst those who drink, those age 18 to 25 consume greater quantities of alcohol than any other group. Physical activity is also tracked. We know that physical activity at work or during leisure time is linked to a 30% lower risk of getting colon cancer. There's also lower risk of breast cancer, maybe lung and endometrial as well. Amongst cancer survivors, there's been a lot of research now that shows that physical activity is associated with better quality of life and is associated with better prognosis. And then there's also some thought that physical activity reduces the amount of weight gain for various cancers like breast, where there is
tendency to gain weight while they're getting treatment, as they go through treatment. So this is the percentage of adults age 18 and older with no physical activity in their leisure time. It's by sex from 1997 to 2010. And what it shows is, so the black line is both sexes, the triangles on the top is females, and then the circles is males. So as you can see, the women tend to actually report less leisure activity compared to men overall. And then the overall is about 33%, 32% that report no leisure time activity. Sorry. Okay, so if we break this down by race, again, there's racial disparities. So amongst Hispanics, they have the highest rate of not reporting any physical activity, a little over 40%. Non-Hispanic blacks also have low rates of activity. They're at the highest right now. And then non-Hispanic whites, they have the lowest rate, so about less than 30%. Those who are poor tend to report less physical activity. So those who are less than 200% of the poverty line, over 50% in 2010 it used to be over 50%, but now about maybe 45% or so, or a little higher than that, report no physical activity at all. And then compared to people who are above 200% of the poverty line, about 26% or so report no exercise. So this also varies by education level. So those who are more highly educated are less likely to report no physical activity compared to those with less than high school education. So about 50% of individuals with less than high school report no leisure time activity. And this shows pretty much the same thing at 2011. So this is by race, and so amongst those with less than high school education, this is shown in red. So African Americans would be the least, but it's not too different right across. Amongst those with high school or more, then you see that the rate of leisure type inactivity is lower, but it's highest amongst the African Americans. And then if we look at high school students, this is important because in the 1990s, there was a sharp decline of individuals who were not taking physical activity in schools. And then this is kind of sort of flattened out over time. But what it shows is that as students age and go into the higher years, that a lot of them will drop physical activity from their program. So women, just to go through the demographics, so women are more likely than men not to engage in leisure time activity. I'm not sure why it's doing that. It was doing that earlier, but I don't think it's the mic. No, it's not the mic. Okay, I'm going to keep going. Blacks and Hispanics are more likely than whites to report no activity. And it's more common in that with those with less education and lower incomes. And then amongst youth, physical activity is lower among females, especially black females. And then it decreases as the children get older. So obesity, we know, is associated with a lot of different cancers: colon, postmenopausal, breast cancer, esophageal, renal cell. And so there's studies show that obesity and being overweight accounts for or increase the risk of death from many cancers, accounting for up to 14% of cancer deaths in men and 20% of cancer deaths in women. So the way that BMI, or the way that weight is classified, is usually by body mass index studies. I don't think it's this. Let's try this. No. So a healthy weight are, is considered BMI of 18 and a half to 20, less than 25. Overweight is from 25 to 30, and then obesity is any BMI greater than 30. And so in the 1990s or even earlier, really the prevalence of the three groups, distribution of the three groups was about a third, a third, a third. So about a third of people were normal weight, a third of people were overweight, and about a third of people were obese. And then across time, as you can see from the 1990s onwards, there was really an increase in the rate of So over time, those rates have increased, and so what you see is really it's at this later time that it's a third. It was a third, a third, a third, and then in more recent times that the rate of obesity actually has surpassed the normal weight and the overweight individuals. I'm gonna go a little fast. So trends in obesity at this spot, this is looking at obesity across time from 1960 to 2010. And really, again, it's the sort of early 1990s that from the late 80s to the 90s that really there was that epidemic of obesity occurring. And this is what's in both sexes, both in men and women, with about 36% of individuals now being classified as obese in 2010. So this is in 2014. This is the rate of obesity among U.S. adults. And so as you can see, green is less than 20%. There was actually no state that had less than 20% reported obesity in the United States. So you had California, Colorado, with between 20 and 25%. Obesity, and then the highest rates of obesity, which are shown in red and darker shades of red, occur primarily in the Midwest and in the southern states. But if you break this out by race, you can see there's a lot of racial disparities in obesity. And so amongst the non-Hispanic whites, the rates of obesity is actually much lower, where green is between 20 and 25%. So there's a lot more states that fall into that. And then again, you get the concentration of obesity occurring in the South and parts of the sort of, I don't know what this part is called, Midwest. And then amongst non-Hispanic blacks, really they have much higher rates of obesity. So for instance, amongst women, the rate of overweight and obesity approaches 80%, and so here you see that the South, the Midwest, that the rates of obesity amongst blacks is really high, and then Hispanics are a little bit in the middle, slightly lower than blacks. Okay, so I'm going to skip this. This is just showing the same idea. This is by male and female by race, and so really you don't see a lot of difference by race in male rates of obesity, but amongst females, individuals with the highest rates of obesity are African Americans, and then this is Hispanic, and then the black is all individuals, and then whites are the lowest. This is for children, and so here, amongst all the different age groups, the rates of obesity has increased over time. From the 1970s to 2010, it's really plateaued out a little bit in more recent years, which is good. So just to summarize, overweight and obesity are most common amongst blacks and Mexican American women, and the same pattern is seen for children and teens within those groups. And one thing that's apparent is that if you're overweight as a child, you're more likely to become overweight as an adult. So as with adults, the trend towards excess weight amongst children, what happened was that there was this great increase between the 80s and the 1990s, but then since then, in recent years, it's really stabilized. All right, let's see if we can do this. Have people seen this in other classes? Because they have. I'm going to go through these really fast so we can get to survivorship.
Have you guys seen this in other classes at all? No? Yes?
Okay. So this is like incidence of cancers 2015. So amongst men, the main ones are prostate, lung, colon. Amongst women, it's breast, lung, and colon. If you look at probability over lifetime, men, it's 1 in 2 will get cancer. Amongst women, it's 1 in 3. And then if you look at trends and incidence rates across time, you see that really in more recent years that the incidence of cancer is coming down or at least stable. And for men, this peak, everybody knows, so this is that when prostate-specific antigen tests came in for prostate cancer, and then you get this bump in increased incidence of diagnosis for prostate cancer. So this is the trends across time. So here again is the sort of that PSA bump, and there's been a decline in prostate cancer incidence rates since. There's the decline in lung cancer rates because of reduced rates of smoking, and then there's been declines in colon as well. And then amongst women, we see breast was pretty steady for a while and has declined a bit. Lung cancer was peaked and is kind of on the decline. Colon cancer as well is coming down. In 2015, there was a focus on ductal carcinoma in situ incidence rates, and this was looking at mammographic screening prevalence by poverty status. So the blue was low poverty, medium, purple's medium poverty, and then red is high poverty, and this is from 1992 to 2010. And what it shows is that, so this is the rate per 100,000, and then this is the percent mammogram in the past 2 years. And what it really does show is that individuals who are more affluent are, individuals who are more affluent are more likely to be diagnosed with DCIS because they participate in screening, whereas individuals who have high poverty rates are less likely to be diagnosed with DCIS because they're less likely to engage in screening. And so the point here was that basically what we're seeing is that the prevalence of DCIS really mirrors the prevalence of mammography in these populations. If we look at incidence rates across race, black men are most likely to be diagnosed with cancer, more so than white men. And then white women and black, and then white women are slightly have higher slightly cancer incidence compared to black women. Okay. And I think this shows pretty much the same thing. And then for children, the main cancers for children 0 to 14 is acute lymphocytic leukemia, and then brain and CNS tumors. And in adolescents from 15 to 19, it's Hodgkin's and thyroid carcinoma. So across time, the incidence rates has sort of gone up slightly, but there's really been a sharp decline in mortality rates over from 1970s to present. And so that has really increased the number of cancer survivors amongst children. And then late-stage diagnosis of cancer. So this is tracked because a lot of times if you're trying to evaluate screening programs, cancers that could be, if you can see a lower number of localized cancers, if you see a decline in more advanced cancers, it's a way of telling you that the screening program is working. And you'll see actually declines in distant cancers before you actually see declines in death rates. And so, for instance, with prostate cancer, after PSA, you see there was a dramatic decline in distant cancers, as well as with colon cancers when colonoscopy and other screening programs went in. With rectum, there's been a decline as well, and then cervix, it's flatter. And then with breast cancer, so 1980s was probably when the late 1980s was when the mammography screening program started. So there was a decline in late stage cancers at that point. Every year, I don't know why it went up and came back down. I don't know if anybody knows it. Every year, I'm like, oh, I wonder why I did that. And I have asked people in the department, and we just can't figure that one out.
Okay. So in relative survival, so here it shows that across time there's really been improvements across all sites for a five-year cancer survivor from 49% in 1975-77 to 68% in 2004-2010. And really those, the cancers that have made major gains are breast cancer, colon cancer, and then cancers that really haven't gained as much as lung cancer, pancreatic cancer. This is by race, so what it's showing is that there's disparities in cancer survival rates between blacks and whites. So there's an absolute difference of 7% if you compare African Americans to whites in terms of their five-year survival rates. You can look at that a bit more closely. And this is by for childhood cancers and adolescents. So the red is 0 to 14 years of age, and then 15 to 19 years of age is shown in blue. So overall, amongst 0 to 14-year-olds, there really isn't a lot of difference between five-year survival rates between boys and girls. But if we look at the older age group from 15 to 19, there's a higher survival rate amongst girls compared to boys. And then if you look at this data broken out by race, compared to whites, all of the African-American, Hispanic, all of the other groups actually have lower five-year survival rates compared to whites. So this is trends in five-year relative survival across time, so 1975 to 2009. And so across this is just to show that there's been these big improvements and across time. And this is both true for the younger age group, 0 to 14, as well as 15 to 19. And primarily, these improvements have been spurred on by really large gains in leukemia and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in terms of survival rates in these two diseases. So then, end of life, the measurements that are often used here is mortality and person years of life lost as being important. Person years of life lost is the years of life lost due to early death from a particular cause or disease. And so really it's used to describe the extent to which the life is cut shorter by the cancer. So on average, each person who dies from cancer loses approximately 15 and a half years of life. This is the number of cancer deaths in the United States. So even though prostate has the highest incidence, the cancer deaths is primarily due to lung and in women as well. So this is the cancer death trends by sex. So for both men and women, it's declining over time. So what this shows is that most of the death rates are actually declining for each of the various disease sites, except for pancreas in the more recent years has actually increased a little bit, and then liver cancer is actually, death from liver cancer is actually going up as well. And that's for men, and this is for women, it's the same idea. Pancreatic cancer and liver cancer death rates have gone up in the recent years. And if we break this out by race, we see disparities again. So men in general are more likely to die than women from cancer, but then amongst that, the group African Americans are more likely to have poor survival than compared to the other groups. So here again showing that black men have the highest death rates from cancer. For children, this is again broken out by 0 to 14 and 15 to 19 years of age. So the incidence of cancer for this group has declined over time. This is 2006 to 2010, and this is for the different groups. So the red is the non-Hispanic whites, and then the blue here is the American Indians. And so here it shows that the group with the highest incidence of incidence of cancer is amongst whites. But despite that, what you see is that for mortality, that is fairly flat. That the mortality, even though the whites are more likely to get cancer, they're not more likely to actually die from their cancers. And similarly, this is true for older children. So then this is looking at the number of deaths that were averted from 1991 to 2011 in men and women. If the assuming due to improvements in treatment and declines in cancer rates. And so about 1 million deaths were averted amongst men and almost 450,000 in women. And then the person years life lost, which is the difference between the actual age of death due to disease and the expected age of death if the person didn't get the disease. And so what this shows is that the cancer that on average is accounts for most of a person years life lost is lung, followed by colon and breast and pancreatic cancers. And if you actually look at the individual person, this makes sense that the childhood cancers are associated with the highest average years of life lost if you're looking at the individual level. So life after breast cancer, or life after cancer. So there's been a lot of advances in the way cancer has been diagnosed and treated. And so there, over time, there's been a large increase in the number of people who are cancer survivors. So more and more people are benefiting from early detection, from screening programs. And so right now, the national data regarding life after cancer was limited and includes survival rates by each stage at diagnosis, economic impact of the cancer, and cancer survivor smoking status. So there was a push in recent years to collect more data on cancer survivors. So cancer survivors is defined as anybody who's been diagnosed with cancer from the time of diagnosis. It used to be way back that it was a cancer survivor was a person who had survived cancer for 5 years, but after that, it was changed to this definition, and the idea was that individuals should be looking ahead from the moment they had cancer to look at factors and to understand factors that can affect their long-term outcomes. So a lot of times in practice, though, when you're dealing with programs, and you look at cancer survival in three distinct phases. So from diagnosis to the end of initial treatment, and then there's this transition period from the treatment to extended survival, and then the long-term survivals. I'm not going to do that. So a lot of times with cancer survivors, when you're looking at programs or you're trying to tailor treatment or develop support programs, you really have to take into account a lot of different experiences across different types of survivors. So you get individuals who remain completely cancer-free. Yeah, they're healthy. They're just healthy. Their cancer does not recur. Sometimes you get individuals who have complications as they continue to live. Some of them will recur and die. Some of them will get a second primary cancer or cancer in a different place. And then some individuals are pretty healthy in certain periods, and then they have cancers and they recur and they're treated and they go back to being cancer free, and then it might recur again. And then there's some individuals who are, you know, they never become disease free. They have cancer, they go through treatment, they're not disease free at any point. So this is the number of cancer survivors basically in the United States. This is from 1970s to 2007, and it's real, or 2012. It shows, but basically there's about 14 million cancer survivors, so about 4% of the population, and increased from 3 million back in 1971. So this is primarily because of the aging of the population and then improved survival rates of individuals who get cancer and are treated. So in 2012, there was about, in total, 6.5 million men who were survivors, compared to 7.2 million women. And then by 2022, this is anticipated to increase up to about 8.8 million in men, and then 9.2 million in women. And most of these amongst women, primarily these are breast cancer survivors, and then amongst men, prostate cancer survivors. So here we show that the majority of cancer survivors are diagnosed 5 or more years ago. So 64% of individuals have survived longer than 5 years, and 15% of these individuals had their cancers 20 or more years ago. And then if we look at who the survivors are in terms of their age, most of the individuals are older. So 71% of survivors are 60 years of age or older. Half of them are 70 years of age or older. And so there's very few, only 5% that are younger than age 40. So really cancer is primarily a disease of the aged. This gives you the median age at diagnosis by tumor site. So again, across all sites, the median age is 66. And then this is from oldest to youngest. So for instance, colon cancer, the median age of diagnosis is 70. So so most individuals are quite old when they're diagnosed. I'm just going to give you just breast and prostate. So in 2012, there's about 3 million women who are living with a history of invasive breast cancer, median age of diagnosis 61. 20% of breast cancer occurs in women who are less than 50 years of age, 40% and greater than 65 years of age, and most women are diagnosed with localized disease. So this shows you in red all races and then broken out by whites and African Americans. So the point here is that even though African Americans are actually less likely overall to be diagnosed with breast cancer compared to whites, that African Americans are actually more likely to be diagnosed with later stage diseases. So 8% are diagnosed with distant disease compared to 5% in whites, and 38% with regional compared to 32% in whites. So some of the current concerns among breast cancer survivors is that they develop lymphedema or swelling. And then since sentinel lymph node biopsy started, there's been a reduced risk of developing lymphedema. And there's some evidence that upper body exercise and physical activity could actually reduce the risk of lymphedema. Other issues that are common amongst breast cancer patients is numbness or tightness, pulling or stretching in the chest, wall, arms, or shoulders. Chemotherapy oftentimes will cause premature menopause in women who are in their 40s. If they're younger, there's impaired fertility among younger patients is a potential issue. The hormonal therapies are likely to increase risk of osteoporosis and can also cause muscle pain and joint stiffness. A similar number of men are survivors of prostate cancer, about 2.8 million. Their median age of diagnosis is much older, at 67. And usually, most prostate cancers are discovered at the local or regional stage, and the 5-year mortality is very high, so it's at 100%. And the 10 and 15-year survival rate is extremely high, about 98% and 91% respectively. So most men will die of their prostate cancer, or die with their prostate cancer, not of their prostate cancer. And then here, what it shows is that African-American men are actually less likely to be diagnosed with regional cancer and localized cancer, but are more likely to be diagnosed with distant cancers compared to whites. So special concerns are prostate cancer patients, erectile dysfunction, bowel complications, there's incontinence. The men who are receiving hormonal treatment may experience loss of libido, menopausal-like symptoms. They'll get hot flashes, night sweats. They're also at risk for osteoporosis. And then over the long term, they're at increased risk for diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obesity. This is true for true for breast cancer patients as well. And then in children, this is 1% of all new. So this represents 1% of all new cancers from birth to age 14. And it's the second leading cause of death in children. So here the point is that the 5-year survival rate has really improved over the past 30 years. for across all sites, from 62% to 83%, and driven again by leukemia. Concerns of childhood cancer survivors is that they can experience treatment-related side effects really a lot of years after their diagnosis. There was a lot of aggressive treatments that were used in the 1970s and 80s, and because of that, this resulted in a pretty large number of late effects. Some of the late effects would be risk of second cancers, organ dysfunction, reduced growth. There's fertility issues, cognitive impairment, and potentially early death. And so, some of the most common second cancers were cancers in the breast, brain, CNS, bone, melanoma, and then acute myeloid leukemia. So some of the issues were, again, potential heart problems, sexual function or reproductive problems. Some of them had delayed puberty, early menopause, infertility. There's also some challenges to the younger population because of insurance coverages as they age out from their parents' plan. And then Medicaid was also an issue because their general coverage lapsed at age 18 or 21, depending on where they lived, which state they lived in. So there were financial issues. So some of the most common effects of cancer and its treatment include pain, fatigue, emotional distress, loss in bone density if you're taking hormonal therapies, cardiotoxicity because of the chemotherapies, and then cognitive deficits. So this is the Institute of Medicine's quality of life model, and so here the issues that should be addressed in improving quality of life amongst cancer survivors are separated out into four domains: so psychological, social, spiritual, and physical. So psychological domain would include things like anxiety and depression, fear of recurrence, cognition, and attention. Social would be family distress, roles and relationship, social support, isolation, finances. Spiritual, meaning of the illness, and physical would be like functional activities, whether they can able to do things, their strength, fatigue, sleep and rest. Pain would go into this box. So the main ones are pain. So this is very common for reducing quality of life, and it's associated with depression and poor functioning. It can interfere with normal activities. It just prevents people from enjoying themselves, and it prevents them from sleeping, and it increases anxiety, stress, and fatigue. So recent meta-analysis showed that the prevalence of pain was really high, 59% amongst those undergoing active treatment, 33% after treatment, and then about 64% with those with advanced cancers. So the main point here is that the idea is that if we can treat pain and relieve pain in about 80% of the individuals, and so that pain should be a focus from the medical community in terms of assessing if there's pain in cancer patients and being able to treat those individuals. So one of the issues in terms of disparities is that pain is often undertreated in minorities, those who are older, age 70 or older, and then in women as well. And this is a serious problem in developed countries, and it's a more serious problem in developing countries. So if you look at the clinical guidelines from WHO and NCCN, they recommend that doctors ask about pain each time cancer survivor comes in. And so this is a scale that's commonly used where you go from no pain up to it hurts the worst. And then the WHO developed an analgesic ladder, so in terms of the treatment approach for different levels of pain, so from mild to moderate to severe pain, and then the different medications that should be sequentially tried to control the pain. Other things that's being researched is complementary methods to control pain. So some of the
some of the methods that are being tried are acupuncture, mind-body imaging techniques, therapeutic massage. There's issues with reimbursement in terms of how to control, in terms of controlling pain or treatments to control pain. So lack of health insurance plays a significant role in which in how pain is treated. So for those who have less health or no health insurance, the likelihood that they'll get appropriate pain treatment is lower. And then depending on health insurance, some will have full access to adequate pain management while others don't at all. And this is worse for those sort of the more vulnerable populations. So those with low SES, the racial and ethnic minorities, and so those individuals in the individuals in those groups are known to suffer from pain more so than the other groups. Fatigue is also a very common side effect in cancer treatments, and it's reported anywhere from 28% to 90% of cancer patients, depending which study you look at. It's reported in virtually all of individuals getting chemotherapy or radiation between 80% and 90%. And really, it's this feeling that you feel this really tired, and it doesn't really get better with your rest or sleep. It's just like this really just aching tiredness. And for a lot of patients, actually, this chronic fatigue doesn't seem to end. So even despite ending their treatment, you still get a proportion of individuals who report persistent fatigue like years out from their diagnosis. So fatigue is thought to be multifactorial. There's a lot of different processes that can contribute to it. There's autonomic failure. There's inflammatory cytokines that are released during treatment. Chemotherapy radiation is associated with fatigue. So depression. So there's a number of factors that contribute to it. And what's interesting is there's been several studies now and a meta-analysis that show that exercise, particularly moderate intensity resistance exercises, can help reduce cancer-related fatigue. And there's also some evidence for psychological interventions and psychostimulants. Another area that's really kind of important and looked at is cancer-related distress. This is really a sort of a complex idea. It sort of takes into account pain, fatigue. It sort of overlaps with a lot of the other domains. It's difficult to identify because of that. And so, and then studies that have sort of looked at this found that about 30 to 40% of cancer patients probably have some kind of diagnosable mood disorder, and this is thought to be an underestimate. So the thought is that if you can detect distress and treat distress early, you can actually improve treatment adherence and reduce depression and anxiety amongst cancer survivors. So in 2008, the Institute of Medicine report came out, and they supported work that was done by the the NCCN, and they put together guidelines for distress management. And so it recommends that during routine screen, that the distress is routinely screened for. And they came up with a measure called the distress thermometer. So the patient indicates that they're under either no distress up to extreme distress. And then there's a list of contributors to the distress. So is it practical problems such as housing, insurance, and the individual would tick off anything that is causing their distress. And then based on this, the idea is that then they can be referred for appropriate services. So another big problem amongst cancer survivors is cognitive deficits. It's referred to a lot commonly as chemo brain. And so a lot of times the treatment and chemotherapy treatment can affect their cognitive function. So individuals report having lower attention spans, difficulty concentrating. They have worse memory. They can't process information as fast. It's hard. The executive function skills go down. This has been reported in a lot of different cancers. It's important in breast cancer, lung cancer, ovarian cancer. And then another area is fear of cancer recurrence. So a lot of cancer patients will report that
one of their big fears that preys upon them is that they're afraid that the cancer will come back. So amongst cancer survivors, about 60% of those 1 year survivors, 1 year cancer survivors will report moderate or severe concerns about having their disease recur. So back in 2004 and then 2006, there was several reports that came out about cancer survivorship. This was in the National Action Plan for Cancer Survivorship, which was released in 2004. And then in 2004, cancer survivorship was the main issue in the President's Cancer Panel Report. And then in 2006 is when the Institute of Medicine report came out. And one of the recommendations that came out under all three reports was that there should be improved surveillance of cancer survivors, and that there should be data collected on these individuals over time. And because of that, this was actually incorporated as an aim by the CDC, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. And so we talked about this a little bit earlier, that this is a program that conducts interviews nationally, and the purpose of it is to monitor various risk factors. And so their usual core topics this is just an example of 2007, some of the topic areas that they were interested in. And so they had core questions, but in addition, in the 2009-2010 questionnaires, the states were allowed to sort of opt into 10 questions that were focused in on cancer survivorship. And so they got these questions from the 1992 National Health Interview Survey supplement that was included, that was administered at that time. And it allowed the states to sort of opt into these questions. And so in 2009, this is really terrible, but only 4 states participated. And in 2010, 10 states participated in the optional module. And so these were the questions that were included, and they were focused on whether they've been, if they received treatment for cancer, what type of doctor provided the health service. And then this question, did any doctor, nurse, or other health professional ever give you a written summary of all the cancer treatments that you received? The purpose of this was that in the recommendations for cancer survivors, it was suggested that people get a written statement from their doctor at the end of their treatment that outlined the diagnosis that they received and the treatments that they received. And then at that point, they should be given a cancer care plan which outlined their follow-up schedule, so that they should be followed up and receive routine checkups after they receive their primary treatments. So they're supposed to get this written down. So what were the instructions written down or printed on paper for you? And then they were asked about whether they had insurance problems, and if they've ever been denied health insurance or life insurance coverage because of the cancer, whether they participate in clinical trials, and then because pain is a major issue, pain control is a major issue amongst cancer survivors, they were asked whether they had physical pain caused by the cancer treatment and whether it's under control or not. So then in 2015, the NCCN actually came up with the survivorship guidelines for clinicians, and then they outlined what should be in a comprehensive treatment plan or support, what kind of support should be provided to cancer survivors. So in their report, they outlined the definition of cancer survivorship and the standards of care. An important aspect was screening for second cancer, so for recurrences and for new primary cancers. That cancer survivors should be seen by a healthcare provider at regular intervals, so there should be follow-up after they receive their treatments. And that there should be an assessment, a baseline assessment of the survivor when they're finished treatment, and then as you follow them forward, then you can collect information and compare it back to baseline. and that survivorship resources should be made available to both the healthcare professional and patients. And so there was also recommendations, specific recommendations made about what types of late effects can occur amongst cancer survivors and the support programs that should be offered to them or made available by their healthcare providers. So a major issue was following them for anthracycline-induced cardiac toxicity. Individuals, because anxiety and depression is such a big issue amongst cancer survivors, that they should get programs targeting anxiety and depression, and that healthcare workers should be aware of this and be able to refer them for extra support. Chemo brain declines in cognitive function, fatigue, pain, sexual function, and sleep disorder should be addressed.
And then the third area was looking at preventive health, so that cancer patients should be counseled about how they could potentially prevent their risk of recurrence and prevent a new cancer from occurring, and so improving prognosis overall. So here the emphasis was on increasing exercise, improving diet, reducing alcohol intake, providing smoking cessation programs, information about sun safety, immunizations, because cancer patients are sometimes more likely to not be able to resist infections, and so getting a flu shot each year was really important, for instance. Weight control, so obesity we know is related to a lot of poor prognosis for a lot of cancers, so it's important. Weight control and body composition are important. And there should be some kind of follow-up with the primary care physician regularly, and that's important because for a lot of cancer patients, they'll have comorbidities, and it's important to take care of these other conditions with the other healthcare providers. And so, in addition to sort of guidelines for the clinician, the American Cancer Society came out with a report. They convened an expert panel, and they came out with a report in 2012 that gave recommendations to cancer survivors on lifestyle factors, so on primarily diet and physical activity. And then in 2014, the World Cancer Research Fund, they actually came out report for diet, nutrition, and physical activity just specifically in breast cancer patients. And so it's just the cartoon here. And so when they evaluated the data, the point was they're trying to reduce cancer recurrence, the development of new cancers, and also of heart disease, because for many cancer patients, particularly those with high survival rates, cancer patients are more likely to die of cardiovascular disease. So here in the cartoon it says, eat less and exercise more. That's the most ridiculous bad diet I've ever heard of. So this is actually the ACS guidelines. So their primary, they had three primary aims that they're telling cancer survivors. So the first is to get to and stay at a healthy weight. We know that obesity increases risk of cancer recurrence, and it's associated with decreased survival rates amongst a number of cancers, including breast and prostate, colon cancer, and it's a risk factor for developing other cancers, heart disease, and osteoporosis. Their second main point was to be more physically active. So this reduces risk of breast, colon, endometrial, prostate cancer. There's been a lot of studies now that have shown that physical activity improves overall survival and that improves quality of life among cancer survivors. So lower risk of other health problems such as heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, osteoporosis. This is really important with heart disease and some of these other chronic conditions, because cancer survivors actually have higher, compared to non-cancer patients, they actually have higher rates of some of these chronic conditions. So it's important to try to reduce the incidence of these conditions after they've been diagnosed. And then, so physical activity is known to benefit cancer survivors across a range of issues. It helps prevent treatment-related weight gain, improves balance, reduces risk of osteoporosis, reduces fatigue, improves quality of life, and it's been associated with better outcomes in general and lower risk of heart disease. Another area that's really kind of now moving up is the idea of sedentary behavior. So we know that sedentary time is associated with increased risk of dying, and this is actually after you adjust for moderate and vigorous exercise. So if you look at cancer patients, this is in breast cancer patients, but if you look amongst them, they actually do exercise more than non-cancer or patients, but they actually have longer sedentary time. So even though cancer patients, at least breast cancer patients, are more likely to exercise, they you know actually sit around for a longer span of time. And then among breast cancer survivors, those this was one result from one study. Those in the top tertile television time have a twofold increased risk of dying compared to those in the bottom third. And this is after adjusting for time exercising. Their risk of death was still higher by 70%. And then the third main point that is recommended is that cancer survivors should eat a variety of healthy foods and then focus more on plant foods. So food choices, and this is primarily, I would say, for colon cancer. Most of these studies have been in breast, colon, and prostate cancer survivors. And sort of the approach is that it's not one food that's important, it's the whole group of foods, and it's the pattern of foods that's important for prognosis. So the best protection comes from a diet that's high in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, includes more fish and poultry instead of red and processed meats, includes nuts and olive oils instead of less healthy sources of fat. So the idea of so in the research, they've looked at prudent diet versus Western diet. So higher intake of Western dietary patterns associated with almost 3 times greater risk of colon cancer recurrence. And that's defined as a diet that's high in meat, fat, refined grains, and dessert, compared to a prudent diet, which is high in fruit and vegetables, poultry, and fish. The recommendation is to limit alcohol intake. The research is really kind of still out on this. Primarily, this has been done with breast cancer patients. And what they found is that there's been about half the studies that show worse outcomes and half the studies that show no harm. And so the jury's still out as to the role of alcohol in prognosis. And that's it. Oh, that went long. All right. I'll be around for extra questions if anybody wants to come up and talk or anything. Thanks very much.